cranberry ketchup.
Right.
You wanted to make sure that I mentioned the podcast, so there I put it at the front.
Right. My dear friend Diana gave us some cranberry ketchup that she canned herself. And you had to eat more roast beef just to have more cranberry ketchup.
It was like dessert. Since we didn't have pie, then I had some little, you know, after we watched the show, then I went and got some more, what was that, roast beef? Is that what we had?
Yep.
Roast beast. And I pulled it out and had a little more with extra cranberry ketchup on it.
Right. I think Diana will be happy to hear that.
Kind of like, it was good. It was really tasty. That was delicious.
Was it what Prairie Home Companion calls a...
Oh.
Right.
Right. Right. So the Prairie Home Companion, they have those ketchup commercials. They
right.
say, so it always has that story of some guy and he's all like, or one of them,
or
one of them's all stressed and yeah, and freaked out. And then the other one always says, you're not getting enough ketchup. Ketchup has natural mellowing agents.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Brought to you by the Ketchup Board. I think those are pretty good. Those are pretty fun.
Yeah. Yep. Very good.
So we watched a movie. We watched a documentary called Ingredients. And it's 66 minutes long, and I thought that we would just fly right through it. And, boy, there was one part about 80% of the way through where it's like it went into some sort of weird time warp, and it added an hour and a half to the movie, like right there. You slept for an hour and a half in the middle of a 66-hour movie.
That was a nice little nap.
But I believe that segment was only actually 8 minutes long.
Okay.
I don't know. And it seemed like the information wasn't that, you know, bizarre or anything. In fact, they made a couple of good points, but it did seem like how it was presented or something was just like, I don't know. It was I know you were asleep, and I was thinking, man, I wish I was there with you.
Well, there were a couple times it repeated itself, you know, but they interviewed a different farmer saying the same thing. I think this was a fairly decent movie for the people out at the Farm Income Forum that are trying to figure out, you know, how to make money. Because these were farmers that were selling directly to restaurants, and they had passionate restaurant owners who supported the flavorful, best food they could get from their local farms. I thought that was a really neat thing to see.
I thought that there was I thought that generally this movie, I'm going to give it a B.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was quite good. I mean, there were several points that I thought could have been better, but it wasn't about the movie making. It was more about what the practices that I saw the farmers doing. And
true.
But I thought this was a pretty good movie. I mean, you know, Jeff Lawton's Food Forest movie, definitely better. Sepp Holzer's movies, definitely better. But this is still quite. It was quite good for the stuff that's in the lines of general feed in the that were normally fed as documentaries. I thought this one was definitely one of the best.
Right. Well, and getting and showing. showing and helping to perpetuate a shift in how we think about food and our food systems. I thought this was pretty good. So we took some notes. You have some notes.
You have lots of notes.
I went a little crazy. It kept me awake for most of the movie.
I thought most of the movie was very good, and it did get to that one. The part where you fell asleep, I do think that one part did seem to just kind of, you know, go into nappy time.
Well, what we really seemed to enjoy is there were nice, pithy little quotes. So one of the...
I enjoyed that there's lots of guys wearing overalls. The smartest people were wearing overalls.
There were lots of guys, lots of young people, young farm workers, guys and gals wearing overalls.
There were some old plump guys,
yes.
You know, that were sage. They were wise and sage leaders.
That's true. The one guy, he had a T-shirt that said, get dirty underneath his overalls. Well, the first quote...
That's right, you're checking out what he's wearing under his overalls.
No, that could get scary. Let's not talk about that.
You just said you did.
No. So, the first quote was a chef saying, I think... if I can remember right, and my notes are accurate enough, the chef thought how they were, I mean, these were gorgeous plates of food that you would just, you know, that they kept showing at all of these lovely, very higher-end restaurants of just everything plated beautifully and herbs stacked on these beautiful cuts, stacked on these beautiful little arrangements underneath. And the chef was saying, you know, this style of food is how we should be eating everywhere, and that restaurants, by buying local and serving the freshest, most flavorful food, should be a catalyst. You know, this should be not just what you eat in a restaurant, but when you go home and say, hey, you know, I want to have something of that at home. And another restaurateur talked about that too, saying, well, we get these eggs from so-and-so who sells them right at the farmer's market. You could get eggs this fresh and amazing too.
Well, I was kind of thinking that the big thing was that I thought when they said that, I thought, what a brilliant point, in that it's kind of the Tesla effect with the Tesla electric car. So many people were like, oh, electric cars, you can only go 40 miles an hour, and they, you know, all these problems, and the charge hardly less. And then they come out with the Tesla Roadster. It goes like faster than goes 0 to 60 faster than any other car you can buy, except for I think a $500,000 Lamborghini. And and it, like, you know, so it sets the pace, but only for your wealthiest people. But once you've done that, there's all these people that are never going to buy a Tesla, but like and then suddenly they become aware of the possibilities of what an electric car really can do. They become aware of the truth. And so
you
basically
said the truth.
That's true. I did.
Aware of possibilities.
Aware of what is possible, can be done, as opposed to like what is not currently done because of all the restrictions, and it's just far too difficult for most people to do. However, when they showed that in this movie, a great example is that moment that they were saying it, they showed a dish that was dominated with dandelion leaves were at the center of what was being presented. And I thought, how brilliant, how utterly brilliant. And then all these people who think dandelions should be poisoned will then be shown to go to this fancy restaurant. And it's like, what we're serving as what is the most delicious thing to complement all this that really sets it off is dandelion leaves. Of all the things that we could put right here, nothing is as good as dandelion leaves. And I think that really helps to change a lot of things. Stinging nettles. Wouldn't it be great to have a lot of stinging nettles appear in gourmet restaurants? And all kinds of foods in that space. So that's what I saw. Now, granted, you know, I think that there's also something to be said for quality of food, quality of flavor, stuff like that. And then somebody can say, well, you know, when I go down to Denny's and I get green beans, they don't taste anything like the green beans at the Fancy Pants restaurant. Why is that? And then I think a good point is to say, well, it's because, you know, we get ours from a local source. When you're eating them, they were picked 4 hours ago.
Well, that and the varieties are more about flavor and quality and nutrition as well. And that was another pithy quote, was that our industrial food is not interested in flavor. And this one gal from the farm they showed repeatedly, was it Ayers Farm or something, said, it takes grassroots pressure, or she thought grassroots pressure was the only reason there is anything truly edible in this country.
Right, we had to stop it and back it up to make sure we wrote it down right.
Yeah, I thought that was, well, yeah.
I wrote down the part about the, right there at the beginning, there was a guy in overalls, And he was basically saying that the thing that you do is you grow for the flavor.
Right.
And so all the decisions that you make when growing are about how to get the best possible flavor.
Well, and that was a group of farmers that several of them had actually literally lost the farm. They had lost their farm. They had gone under trying to do the traditional commodity or industrial agriculture. And they were just, they weren't thinking of it as food. They were thinking of it as a commodity. I thought that was another brilliant quote. And a French chef came in and said, no, grow for the flavor. And that was, some of them really resisted the idea of a French chef telling them what to do.
I remember that part. Because yeah. This is America, damn it.
Yeah.
We're Americans. We're the best. Yeah. We're number one.
Yeah.
Fucking Frenchies.
Yeah. And there was a lot of pride in the efficient, cheap, the cheapest food ever and massive quantities of cheap food. And America has just, you know, done so great at doing all of this cheap food that it was really different to think about growing it for flavor instead of just mass production. I just thought that was a great thing to point out.
Yeah. Yeah. Right about then, right, like moments later, they had a woman chef come on, and she said that 85% of cooking is about finding the foodstuffs.
Yeah.
Which I thought was just awesome.
Yeah.
It's not just signing up for whatever the Cisco truck brings.
Right.
It's about going out and finding the appropriate ingredients.
Yeah. And she said at first they couldn't find it. And they actually had to send an employee out that they called a forager to go out to the different farms and find local food or find any food that was being grown to the standards they wanted. I thought that was amazing. Yeah. And then the guy raising lamb in Oregon, he was really cool too.
Right. He talked about how when his dad would raise lamb, then they gather up all the lambs, put them in the truck, and then they go down to the lot or whatever it is, the place that you take them.
That buys the lambs.
That buys the lambs, and you unload all the lambs, and once they're all unloaded, and then they have them, then they go and they sit in the office, and then they say, okay, how much are you giving me for the lambs? It's like, you don't even know what the price is until after they have the lambs in their possession.
Yeah, and they can tell you any price they want. It reminds me of, was it Food Inc., where all these growers, chicken growers and other meat product growers, they had to contract for certain prices, and they had to do everything the way Tyson or whoever wanted them to do it, and they had to accept the prices they were given.
Right.
What they were growing, and that's what it sounded like with the lamb.
Yeah, and then the guy, it's like, he said his father never made money at it, and then he kind of ended up doing it.
Doing the same thing.
And then it was the same thing. And then somehow he was in Oregon, but he started selling his lamb to a restaurant in California. And the deal was that they wanted the very best lamb, raised the very best way imaginable.
Yeah.
And he said every way they imagine, or every year they imagine new ways to raise them even better.
Right.
And then they talked a little bit about what those were, and I thought I thought a lot of that the ideas that they had were quite admirable.
Yes. He was doing great things, and he was not apologetic that his lambs cost more. He basically said, we know you can get cheaper lamb from Australia or New Zealand or wherever, but we produce the cleanest, best tasting lamb. You know, they raise it the cleanest possible, in the healthiest way possible. And I see you wrote down
the secret of high quality lamb. So you sit in there. Oh yeah, that's a good note. But I'm going to do this one first.
Okay.
You look at your own notes. Okay. These are my notes.
Okay.
All right. So he said the secret of high quality lamb, and he said something about like, I'm giving my secret. Here's my secret. rapidly growing lambs on lush green feed. And I wrote that down as fast as I could, and I'm not a fast writer, so I hope I got that right. You gotta go watch the movie. We watched it on the Netflix Instant View.
Yeah, that works great.
Yeah. So we got to see it right away. But anyway, that was one. And then the other one that you were pointing at is the thing that I thought was an important point, which permaculturalists, I hope, know, and it seemed to be a recurring theme throughout the whole movie, but they seem to have we saw a lot of monocrops.
We did.
Even though they're saying, this is so much better than an industrial organic, and then, but it's like, dude, you're still doing monocrop, come on. And so, but the thing that the guy with the lamb said is that he saw that parasites were reduced by adding diversity. So when they switched from just sheep and lambs and they started adding in cattle, they saw the parasites get reduced for all animals.
Right.
And then they added in, what was it, geese?
Ducks.
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 Ducks. And then he had, it was something else too. I don't think I saw hogs.
No, not him. No, he would run the sheep first, then the cattle, because he said the cattle are much more resistant to the parasites, and they came in and like vacuumed everything and almost got rid of the parasites that would bother the sheep. And then the ducks came in after the cattle, and then start over again with the sheep.
Right. And so I imagine if you added even more diversity, that it might get even better.
Yeah.
So
I thought it was kind of cool that he heard about that. The greatest single factor in livestock disease is lack of diversity. He heard that at a slow food conference from a doctor of veterinary medicine. I thought that, so that's why I was pointing at your quote about that, because I had written down the same thing.
Well, he had said something about high concentrations of animals, that the greatest source of a disease.
Density, you're right.
Is a high, and
density,
then
it
has
diversity.
Animal density. And it's like not just CAFOs,
right,
but also with paddock shift systems.
Just high density. You're right. It was density,
and
diversity.
I was thinking that is a very interesting point, which I think a lot of the people that do paddock shift systems don't think about. And so I think that's a very good one.
Think about chicken or pig tractors too. That's a massive density.
I don't like those. Yeah. I really don't like them.
I know
okay.
You don't.
All right, what do you got next?
Ah, wow. There was one little snippet in there that was a pet peeve of mine. They were talking about, so they show the bucolic pasture where the guy's raising his sheep and his cows and his ducks, and they show these beautiful farms, even if they are rows and monocrops, and then they show these beautiful restaurant plates, and you know, they're just painting this picture of food, glorious food, and then they go in the grocery store and say, and then we have all this junk, and the way it makes us unhealthy is it's high fat and high fructose corn syrup. And that's just a pet peeve of mine, because it's not the high fat, it's the type of fat.
Right. I think that they're wrong with the high fat aspect. There are some fats that are going to be really, really bad. But all right. Anyway,
that was just a pet peeve.
Throughout the movie, there were things that bugged me. But on the other hand, if we're talking about shows that are the ones that are fed to the general public, I think that this one is superior to the others, superior to most of the others, and at the same time, yes, it still has flaws, just like all the other ones do.
Right.
Also.
Right. True. And that was just a tiny snippet out of all of this. There was this other produce grower that they showed as a supplier to some different gourmet restaurants, and it was really interesting to me how the people at the restaurant, I think it was a Portland restaurant in this one, and this farmer's name was Sheldon. He had the ponytail, I think, right? Do you remember him? Anyway, so...
I was looking for overalls. Damn, that guy looks good.
He didn't have overalls on.
Okay.
So you didn't notice him.
Some guy.
Yeah. But what happened is he was really experimenting with growing the newest, most flavorful food he could. All of these new kinds of vegetables, heirloom vegetables, things that would just really pop on the restaurant plate, and the chefs just loved it, and they loved cooking with whatever he had available that day, because he would just bring them whatever was the best, the cream of the crop from his crop, and they would
change the menu.
They would, yeah, create menus around the produce he brought in because it was so good. And he went around to all the different restaurants and talked to the different chefs, and then the chefs could kind of hear what was going on with their competition, and so he was a valuable resource for more than just produce. And then the way he was talking about his business and how he was growing things. Now, he had the most diverse cropping. He had what he called a patchwork. So his things were in rows, but they were wide rows, and they were like little squares of types of vegetables instead of long rows of things. So his was a little bit more diverse than some that we saw. But I liked that he said he and his wife, they wanted to be able to retire from what they were doing. They didn't want to have to do this for a while and then go hurry make money at something else so that they could have a nest egg to retire on. He was looking at making a good profit so he could retire comfortably. And it sounded like he had a really good thing going the way he was doing it.
Kind of like the guy with the lambs.
Yeah.
It's kind of like, yes, there are places where you can get lamb from China that is really cheap, or lamb from all these other places where it is just a teeny tiny fraction. And it's like, so what? That's not my market. And it sounded like a lot of these guys started off with the idea of, like, they are trying to compete with in that market, and it's like, it's so tough, it's so hard, but it's also icky, but once they start traveling in this whole new area of, like, I'm going to make the best lamb that you can possibly get, it turns out that there are buyers for it, and then they start, all their problems kind of melt away.
Right.
You know, and not only are there buyers for it at a higher price, but it seems to me like there's probably even a higher still price.
Right.
They can continue to make things better and better and better every year, and, you know, the higher price is okay.
Well, and that was part of the message all the way through this movie, was if you're growing things in a healthy, sustainable manner, and they talked about how sustainable is a difficult thing to define, but basically, you know, you're growing your sheep in the healthiest way so they have the least parasites, you're growing your vegetables in the healthiest way so that they, you know, are the most pest and disease resistant too. You're also getting the best tasting food by doing that, and you're harvesting it right before you're serving it, sometimes hours, sometimes within a day. You know, all of that means better nutrition, better flavor, and they just kept repeating all of that. It just tastes better.
A lot of it was comparing, I mean, I think everything that we saw was where they're talking about the need to be better than standard organic. So a lot of it was talking about, you know, how their stuff compares to standard organic.
Yeah.
Standard conventional organic. Not conventional, but conventional organic.
Right.
You know, and so they're talking about, yeah, you can go and you can get yourself, you know, organic this, but by the time you get it from the grocery store and use it in your restaurant or whatever, it's already 10 days old.
Right.
But, or you can get the stuff that's up from his farm, and it's only hours old.
Right. There are certain organic sprays that are insecticides that you can still use, whether, I don't know what, whether he's talking about BT or something like that. I don't know.
Well, and then he started talking about how it comes from a huge monocrop field.
Right.
And while I'm looking at his stuff, I'm thinking, dude, you got your own monocrop.
Yeah.
He's doing kind of a patchwork thing. So the monocrop isn't as big, but it's still monocrop.
Right. But so, yeah, there's all these things with the big agriculture organic that still are not very good. Are not producing the best food.
They're still going to grow the varieties that are that variety because they can be shipped better and they store better, whereas these guys had a lot of emphasis on what has the best flavor. And oftentimes what has the best flavor has a really awful shelf life.
Yeah, true. I liked, they did a couple quick little interviews with an economist, and the economist claimed that when you're buying local in season, it's as cheap or cheaper than, you know, conventional food or grocery store organic food. He said, you know, when you're buying out of season, that's when it may cost a little more. But later he was saying, you know, well, we really should be finding a way to support our local farmers and have them. He was implying, I don't think he said this specifically, he was implying that somehow we should have that system subsidized instead of, you know, the big ag subsidized.
I like the idea. I mean, if we're going to talk about, like, you go to your farmer's market, would be a good place.
Yeah.
I think that the key is that I want to support, definitely, I want to support my local farmers who do a good job. I want to support the local farmers where they picked it just hours earlier. And their standards are way beyond organic.
Yeah.
I don't want to support the local farmers that aren't local, really. Like, the food that they're presenting comes from 1,000 miles away, but they got a big sign out there that says local. And I don't want to support the stuff that has any chemical gick on it. There are ways to raise everything without the chemical gick. And I could come up with a long list of stuff that I don't want to support.
Right.
And the trick is that it's like you got to go up, you got to talk to these people, get to know them, and you got to know what questions to ask, and you got to be able to figure out whether or not they're lying.
Right. Well, and some of the best, you know, examples of kind of what the movie was all about, that saying, well, you don't want to be buying this, you want to be buying this, you know. And one of the best quotes was also in the trailer, and I tried to write it down. I didn't write it down verbatim, but this is one of the times we paused the movie too. You shouldn't be buying garlic that came in the hold of a ship from miles and miles away, nestled between sex toys and flip-flops. And I think that's, you know, that paints a picture.
Yeah, garlic grows round, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. And it's something that keeps.
Yeah.
And it's like the reason, and in fact, it keeps, which is how it can make the trip over from China in the hold of the ship.
Yeah.
And so, it's not that sex toys are poisoning the garlic in any way, but it does make sense, though, that it should be one of the things that you buy locally. And you know, I like the idea of Missoula's Winter Garden, and you can go out, or Winter Market. Yeah, Missoula's Winter Market, and they do. They have all kinds of things that keep out there, like garlic, and they have, you know, all your winter squash, and they have all kinds of things that are, you know, available in the wintertime. I didn't see sunchokes out there, but the last time I was there, maybe I didn't look hard enough.
Well, and they highlighted a winter market, I think, in Portland, too, and how, you know, it was doing amazingly well. Because people think there isn't fresh produce in the wintertime, even in a temperate climate like Portland or even Seattle, people think, oh, there's not local produce, but there can be. And this Portland market was showing that, which I think is pretty awesome. And the Missoula, winter market in Missoula, wow.
Yeah, yeah. All right, so now we saw a fair bit of biodynamic.
Yes.
biodynamic monocrops.
Yeah, wasn't that? That seemed strange. But
it's like, yeah, it just kept going on, more monocrop. Yeah, we're better than those monocrops. Look at our monocrop. Oh, man. And the one guy decided that he was going to explain to us what biodynamic is. He said it's very simple. It's organic plus the lunar calendar. And I kind of thought, I'm pretty sure biodynamics a lot more than that. He did make some interesting points about like when the sap is up or down in the plants according to the lunar calendar, thus, you know, when you should be harvesting it for best flavor. I thought that was, you know, a nice point. But, yeah, I do think that a lot of the biodynamic folks would take exception to a lot of that. There's a lot more to it.
And I appreciate the idea of trying to find a simple way to describe it to someone, to give someone a taste of it. So,
My last note that I have is no culture spends less on food or more on healthcare than the American culture.
Right.
And then the guy said something like, so take your pick. Are you going to spend that money on food, or are you going to spend that money on healthcare? And I could probably fill several podcasts on my philosophies on healthcare in the United States.
We had a little talk on that before the movie.
Yeah, there was a little bit of that, but we barely touched into the stuff that are my philosophies in healthcare, and that is that I'll try to, in a nutshell, I believe that 90% of what we spend on healthcare goes to insurance companies. Mm-hmm. And I believe that if we just simply outlawed insurance companies, then what most people pay on health care would probably be less than what they pay in their copay for those that have insurance.
Right, right.
And so if you go to see your doctor and all the, you know, basically going to see your doctor could be something of the order of $20. Whereas right now, with all the insurance gobbledygook that goes on, it's easily a couple of hundred.
Right.
But hey, that's something where I think most people are going to utterly not believe what I have to say, and I have a mountain of stuff behind it that makes me believe that. And the few times I've actually engaged somebody, I tend to just drive people nuts and piss them off, and they hate my guts.
Well, I think getting back to the food issue, you know, you can spend your money on food or on healthcare. As a mom, I've seen a lot of that with my kids. I could cure and prevent their ear infections by changing what they ate. I could help them get over a cold or flu faster by changing what they ate. It's amazing how many different things my kids were related to with food. You know, it's just amazing to me. It's phenomenal.
Food as medicine.
Yes. Well, or
food as health.
Or food as ill health. There are certain foods that were making my kids sick. Sugar. Regular dairy from the source was making them sick. So, causing a lot of different problems. I see I'm a huge advocate of buying healthy food to be healthy, and I don't really understand how people don't get that connection to their health, and how people think they can't afford healthy food, and yet they think they can afford a lot of entertainment or other things.
Right.
And to me, I just don't understand that priority. It's terrible. It's a terrible judgment of mine, but I don't get it.
That leads into a couple of quick thoughts. One is that when people say organic food is so expensive, then the response is, well, have you priced cancer lately? And I frankly don't shop for anything but organic food, so I'm not really sure how expensive it is relative to the factory stuff, the chemical-y stuff. But I would say that another thing is that's been coming up a lot lately is people who keep saying, you know, Monsanto is bad, but then the only food that they buy is Monsanto food.
Right. And I was just using an example of that the other day. Somebody, you know, going to Costco and stocking up on, you know, a bunch of the frozen quick food for their teenager, you know, that's full of corn and GMOs and all of that kind of stuff. But I do like the guy's follow-up comment, the guy who said, we're the nation that spends the least on food and the most on healthcare. He followed it up by saying, well, you can pay the doctor or you can pay the farmer. Who do you want to pay?
Yeah, right.
So,
but then you got to pay the right farmer, too.
Well, yeah.
I think that's his point.
Exactly.
So,
and the economist came back and was talking about, are we ready to move past that?
I'm ready to, yeah.
The economist, just one more thing, came back and talked about the challenge of making this kind of food accessible, because it really is, some people, their food budget truly, truly is a struggle for them. They're month to month or paycheck to paycheck, and you want, he was thinking that we need to make it accessible. And then they talked about the economic impact of buying local and supporting local farms and supporting these types of farmers, and that the impact of doing that is diffuse. It's a little bit harder to easily measure because it's the little guys, it's the, you know, it's the restaurants, it's a smaller, more diffuse economy than the great big agriculture where everything feeds into one of the big four corporations.
Oh, right.
Yeah. I thought that was a good point, that that's different, you know, and it's a different type of economy. And,
Well, and along those lines was the point that they made in this movie that's made in several of these kinds of movies. The whole thing of like, you know, this meat is funky, so we have to recall 10,000 cows worth of beef because, you know, some funk got mixed into the big mix.
Right.
As opposed to the technique where if one cow is sporting funkiness, then, you know, all the other 9,999 cows worth of meat don't need to be recalled, you know, when you do it that way.
Right. Because the factory-produced hamburger, one package of hamburger could be...
They all get mixed together.
Thousands of cows, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, scary.
Kind of similar. But, all right, what else you got on your big list of notes?
That's it.
What? Seems like my list was shorter, but, you know, we spent just as much time on my list.
I think I know why that was. Because you're good at thoroughly explaining things.
What? All right. Well, you know, I thought the part that you slept through was the part where the guy started talking about the kids.
Right.
And they had a thing where they were bringing kids out onto the farm, and they're like saying, hey, kids, what is a vegetable? And, you know, that's about the part I think you nodded off. And
the answer was, it's the part of plants that we eat.
So you see? Yeah, you were paying attention.
See? I tell ya.
You hadn't fallen asleep just yet. Okay, all right. Good to know.
Such harassment.
So they did have an interesting point where they said something about when they went into cafeterias and they presented the kids with fresh produce next to, you know, the other options, that the kids did take more fresh produce and they did average more than the average USRDA for, you know, these bits of fresh produce. So I think their point was is that fresh produce is too often not an option in school cafeterias.
Right.
And I thought that was kind of interesting that people crave it. People want it.
Well, just think about it. Think of a carrot and some of those little baby carrots that they ship around in the bags that they bleach to kind of keep from turning slimy. How woody and dry some of those old carrots can taste compared to a garden fresh, crisp, sweet, tender carrot. Or even a sugar snap pea. You know, when sugar snap peas get old, have you ever bought them from the grocery store and they're a little old? They're bitter. But a sugar snap pea that's fresh and just, you know, just right is a sweet treat. It really is. I mean, and kids can tell that.
Well, I think that, you know, if we want to work in fresh produce, let's just talk about the idea of, I don't know, I think for almost anybody, possibly one of the best food experiences they've ever had in all of their lives is a really good peach. I mean, when you caught one, I mean, I've had some bad peaches in my day.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, that one was hard, that one was bland, that one was pithy. But
yeah.
When you've got a really good peach, then yeah, the kids are going to line up to eat those peaches and they're going to clean you out. And I think that's kind of part of what was being said too, what was part of this experiment, is that they're feeding them the really good fresh produce as opposed to this factory crap.
Yeah.
And so I think that I think there is a lot to be said for fresh produce that is really good as opposed to the stuff that, you know, has been through the factory in 8 different ways.
Right.
And I don't know, did we mention on a podcast the whole bud nip thing? I think we did, didn't we?
We did.
Okay.
We did.
So I think even the stuff that's industrial organic is going to be, you know, take a distant back seat. And, you know, to wrap in yet another podcast from the past, I you know, they talk a lot about the farmers markets and a lot of the very local foods, although the lambs seem to travel probably 500 miles or so, that I think that I really, really like the idea of the super local, the one where it's the honor system farm market that's just a block or two from your house, or maybe you drive by it on your way home from work or something like that.
Well, and they did touch sort of on the political issues with the loss of farmland in the movie, which I skipped over my notes on that because, you know, there was a little bit of the movie where they're kind of saying, we need to protect our farmlands and have, you know, really good urban growth boundaries so we can have super, super local food, like what you were just describing. And that's part of my notes I kind of skipped over, but you kind of mentioned it. And that's a political thing that's really goofy. I think if people just are making more and more money at it, then it'll be worthwhile for them to buy the land instead of a developer buying the land to sell, build more homes.
Well, I kind of wonder a little bit about, like, you know, how soon until, like if you think about the urban farm, the idea of, because one of the things this gal said is, we want the cities to build up and not out. We don't want them to encroach on our farmland. And I was kind of thinking, I don't know about that. I mean, I would rather have, like, lots of farmland mixed into the city to have the super local thing, you know, and maybe the thing is like, rather than having cities, which we're going to have cities,
right,
then maybe the thing is to have lots more little towns and have it spread out more. So rather than concentrating everybody in the city like that, to spread things out so that way you can have the super local. You can have the thing where within, you know, people live in a suburb or they live in an urban with a yard kind of a place, but there is that yard a block over where they raise a mountain of food and they sell it and it is awesome food and buy that.
Right.
So I just the idea of, like, you know, build up and not out, then it's kind of like saying, okay, well, we don't get to have the super local stuff inside the city limits, and it has to be trucked in. And so, to them it seemed very clear. They're saying build up, not out. They're all like, "Yay, you're so smart!" And I'm kind of thinking, you know what? It's not that simple. And the other thing is it's like, okay, we're gonna protect farmland. I'm thinking, what? You know, for Monsanto, because that's who has most of it, is the Monsanto package farmers, the ones that are signed up with Tyson, the ones that are doing all the things that we think are icky. We're going to protect it and make it even cheaper for them. We're going to make laws for them. I mean, I think it's one thing to say we're going to protect this farmland, which is what they were doing in the example. We protected this farmland and we're doing this better than organic thing. Okay, yeah, I can stand behind that. Right. But on the other hand, it's like, we're going to make a law that makes it so that this farmer who has been totally screwed by, you know, all the laws that have been made by Monsanto, that now he's finally selling his farm. Oh, but by the way, you're not allowed to get top dollar for your land from the people that would put houses on it. We're going to force you to sell it to Monsanto for peanuts.
Well, I think there's a variety of things to look at with a lot of that besides just preserving farmland and who are you preserving it for. The one farmer was an example. He lost his farmland, but his lease was up or something like that, and his clientele wanted him to keep farming so badly that they kind of either created or connected him with a farmland trust, and then he had farmland to farm on.
Wasn't that dead president? That was the dead president's land, wasn't it?
I don't know.
Buchanan or something like that?
Yeah.
He was like part of the, he was the, it was like the eighth president of the United States, and he was the founder of the Free Soil Party.
Oh, right. They mentioned that. Yes.
I thought you wrote that down.
I did write that down. It's something else I skipped over.
You're saying you skipped over your notes.
I did. Martin Van Buren.
Van Buren.
The Free Soil Society.
There you
anyway,
go.
Anyway, some of the farmers talked about saving their own seed, too. There's another note I've noticed. But I think the idea of subsidizing the local farms and supporting the kinds of farms we want to encourage would be a lovely thing if some of our tax dollars went to that instead of subsidizing these massive, massive corn and soybean operations.
I would rather just see the tax dollars stop going to subsidize what they're subsidizing, and then these farmers will do great because what they're doing is great.
Mm.
Let the market decide. Why? I don't. Because the other thing is once you start saying, okay, now the government's going to go and subsidize that guy, I can't help but think that one of the steps in there is that the government is going to want to get all up in their shit.
And say,
by the way, this grant is from the USDA, which is managed by Monsanto. So where's your Roundup? You know, you say, how can you have an organic operation without Roundup? You know, it's kind of like, I don't know. I prefer the idea. Let's level the playing field and let people decide. I think that there is a lot to be said for a better flavor of food.
Yeah.
And I think I think a lot of people are going to be willing to pay a little bit more in order to get a far superior tasting food. And I think that, you know, when people learn more and more and more about where cancer comes from, I think we're going to see a lot of people moving towards organic. I think we're already seeing a lot of that. A lot of people are having such severe health problems that, you know, they're finding out, they're discovering that their health problems go away when they eat organic.
Yeah.
And so, and then as the organic standard degrades, then we're going to start hearing more and more about, you know, other qualities of food that are going to help prevent these problems.
Yes. All this talk about food, I think we need to return to the cranberry ketchup. I might have to go get some.
And we've come full circle. So if you like this sort of thing, come on out to the forums at permies.com, where we talk about cranberry ketchup,
farm income,
homesteading, and permaculture
all the time.